This is Audible.
Four Weddings and a Festival. Written by Annie Robertson and read by Ellie Hayden. Chapter 1. Wednesday, 25th of April. If I were a character in the opening titles of a Richard Curtis film, I probably wouldn't be standing here with my hand inside a chicken. I'd be dashing around in my shabby chic Notting Hill muse house, throwing on some fabulous attire, sprinting to a wedding or getting ready for my dream job. Only I don't live in a London muse because, last I looked, I'd need several million in my account and I'm lucky if there's several hundred in there at any one time. No. As luck would have it, I rent a house in Notting Hill's poor distant neighbour, Acton, with my blissfully loved-up flatmate who, I admit, does have a whiff of a Richard Curtis-esque roomie about her. Lizzie isn't quite as revolting in her habits as the Welsh bloke from Notting Hill, or quite so irreverent as Scarlett from Four Weddings, but she certainly is untidy and exceptionally scatty. But she also happens to be one of the nicest people I've ever met, and I'm not quite sure how I'll cope when she gets married next month and finally moves in with her adorable fiancé, Jack.
"Hiya, Bee!"
she calls, closing the front door of our small terraced house.
"In the kitchen!"
Lizzie appears in the doorway, holding a handful of post in one hand and a cake box in the other. Her bicycle helmet is still perched on her head, her blonde pixie hair poking out through the holes. I have serious reservations about Lizzie cycling in London. She can barely walk down the pavement without colliding into a lamppost. She's always been that way. She used to fall off the balance beam at school with predictable and spectacular regularity.
"Bad day at work?"
She gestures to the mountain of vegetables yet to be prepped for the overly ambitious dinner I'm attempting to cook for the girls. Lizzie knows that a spot of cooking is my ultimate wind down, even if I'm not very good at it. Sir Hugo was in one of his moods.
"What was it this time?"
she asks, putting down the cake box and absently flicking through the post, mainly wedding RSVPs. "The usual. Things not being done that he absolutely remembers giving instructions to be carried out."
"But I'm assuming that as his PA you made everything shipshape with a sprinkling of your Anne Hathaway magic."
I laugh dryly. If only my work life were quite as rosy as Lizzie perceives it to be. "How was your day?"
"The usual madness."
She casts the RSVPs aside and hangs her helmet on the edge of the radiator.
"I've a new patient who thinks everyone in the room is a penguin. We spent 3 hours making papier-mâché fish."
"As you do?" I hand her a potato peeler, wishing that my days were as creative and worthwhile as Lizzie's. She had her mind focused solely on becoming an art therapist since a Year 10 careers day. It's possibly the only thing Lizzie's mind has ever been focused on, apart from Jack and having babies. Oh, and maybe dog agility, which was her big obsession when she was 12. I, on the other hand, had the grand plan of becoming a famous jewellery designer, but when I realised that wasn't going to pay the bills, I wound up working as an assistant to the principal of the art college Lizzie and I went to. My first job of many in the unplanned route to becoming a career PA. I long for the creative freedom Lizzie has at work, though probably not the penguin-seeing patience and maybe a smidge less of the 9-to-5. I always fancied a more nomadic existence, unlike the one my mother had, tied to the house and her kid.
"You do remember that Hannah and Kat are coming around at 7:30 for dinner?"
Apparently Kat has news. She doesn't say as much, but it's clear from her widened eyes that she's forgotten.
"I'll have a quick shower and then I'm all yours,"
she says, leaving me to peel the potatoes and to contemplate what Kat might be going to tell us. By the time the doorbell rings, the veggies are prepped, the chicken is in the oven, I'm out of my work clothes, and Lizzie is just about decent in her pajama bottoms, though she's yet to find the corresponding top.
"I hope for your sake this is one of the girls, and not Simon,"
I say, going to the door. Admittedly, it wouldn't be the first time my boyfriend has seen Lizzie without her top on. She's constantly in a state of undress, trying to figure out if an item of clothing is clean but hanging somewhere in the house other than her wardrobe, or dirty, but still possibly wearable if only she could find it under the bed, over the banister, or on top of the microwave.
Simon isn't interested in my breasts. Yours are far superior.
I can hear her in the front room, tossing the sofa cushions about, looking for her top. With a roll of my eyes, I open the front door.
Hi, Hannah. How are you?
Starving.
She stoops her tall frame over my short one, giving me a light, sweaty hug, then undoes her laces before placing the trainers neatly beside the front door. Food's almost ready.
Unlike Lizzie. What she lost this time?
Lizzie pops into the hallway, triumphantly holding her top aloft. Found it! I shake my head, laughing, wondering what I'll do without her. Who will make me smile when I've had a tough day? Who will bring me breakfast in bed on a Saturday morning? Or drive me crazy by trying and failing to dry several weeks' worth of laundry all at once in the tumble dryer? I should be doing something about it. Advertise for someone new or put out some feelers. But I can't bring myself to. No one could ever match Lizzie.
Why can't I have a flatmate who walks around topless?
Asks Hannah, scrunching her long dark hair with the towel, then wrapping it round her neck to keep warm after the 8-mile run from her work in Lincoln's Inn. You'll have one soon enough, I say, leading her through into the kitchen to check on the food and to put the tartlets and salad she's brought into the fridge.
Remy isn't really one for nudity.
Really?
That surprises me.
Given that she's a diminutive French yoga instructor, Hannah's fiancé strikes me as exactly the sort who would parade around in the all-together at any given opportunity. Do Grandma and Grandpa Jones know about Remy yet? Hannah shakes her head. Do they still think she's a man? Asks Lizzie, pulling on her top in the hall.
Yep,
I say, with a chuckle. Hannah, you have to tell them.
I know, and I will. I just haven't found the right moment. I can't believe you've managed to keep your sexuality from them this long. It's not as if it's ever been a secret from anyone else.
Hannah never really came out. She just always liked girls and was never afraid of that. Other than when it came to telling her grandparents. Remind me again why you didn't tell them at the time? I ask, recalling the moment Hannah told them about her engagement on Skype. The connection wasn't great, and they misheard she for he, and Hannah, for some reason, chose not to correct them. At the time, it was funny. Now it's just kind of weird.
Because it would break their hearts.
Do you really think so? I ask. They never struck me as being narrow-minded.
Maybe not, but they're super traditional. Don't you remember? When I went to law school, they imagined my life away. They saw me marrying a male lawyer, giving up my career, and never wanting for anything ever again.
Right. But surely they'll see that you provide for yourself now, and that your love for Remy is more important than any plan they might have had for you. Bee's right, says Lizzie, now fully clothed. And besides, aren't they paying for the wedding?
Don't remind me.
Clock's ticking, I say, opening the oven. Only 2 months until the big day. You need to tell them soon. Hannah pinches a sizzling hot roast potato from the tray and then does the fast breathing of someone who's just put something scorching in their mouth. And besides, people who moved to Australia in their 70s aren't the sort who would care about gay marriage. Hannah half chokes on the potato.
They moved because of my grandmother's arthritis, not because they planned to surf in their old age. My grandparents aren't the laid-back type.
I shrug uncertainly. I only have a dim recollection of her grandparents from when we stayed at their house once when we were about 11. They let us watch 4 weddings and a funeral, even though it was a 15 rating. They seemed pretty laid back to me. That was the first time we saw the film, and we fell head over heels with it, watching it over and over, each of us falling for a different character. Lizzie wanted to marry Tom. Kat drooled over Charles. Hannah was infatuated with Fee, and I always had a soft spot for David, Charlie's deaf brother. And then one night, when we were about 13, Lizzie made us swear a solemn oath that we'd all get married in one summer, to live out the fantasy of our own 4 weddings. Naive as we were, and fueled by Coke and Doritos, we dutifully put our hands on hers and swore our allegiance to the plan. Thankfully, we've all grown up a bit since then. Do you know what Kat's news is? I ask Hannah.
I've no idea.
She hasn't said anything at all.
Not a peep. Wow, I say, thinking how unlike Cat it is to keep a secret. It must be something really big.
We're spinning around to Kylie and setting the table in the dining room when Cat eventually arrives.
Sorry I'm late. Traffic was a nightmare.
She takes off her coat to reveal her white physio tunic, which shows off her super-toned upper arms. I've always been a bit envious of Kat's effortlessly athletic physique. One slackers like me can only dream of having. She tightens her ponytail and empties a big bag of crisps into the bowl on the table.
It's fine. Dinner's a bit behind anyway, I say, studying her to see if there's anything to suggest what might be up.
Kat and I have been best friends since primary school, so if any of us is going to notice something different about her, it's me. I study her face for signs. If she was sick, then I'd see it in her green eyes, which always take on a grey hue when she's under the weather. Changing jobs, I'd see it in her neck and shoulders, and moving house wouldn't be a big deal for Kat, so it can't be that. I'm stumped.
What?
She asks, self-consciously touching her nose and mouth to make sure she hasn't got anything gross on either. It's then I realize I'm not the only one staring at her. All three of us have narrowed our eyes, scrutinizing her for clues as to what the news might be.
Nothing,
Hannah and I say in unison, trying to hide our curiosity by busying ourselves with laying the table.
Lizzie?
Kat asks, knowing that Liz will definitely blab.
They're trying to figure out what your big news is.
Kat smiles wryly and pops a crisp into her mouth.
You can have one guess each.
We pause our table preparations. Hannah, ever the analyst, looks her up and down before saying,
You're moving to New Zealand.
It's not a long shot. Kat's wanted to spend time in New Zealand practicing physiotherapy since her geography teacher, Mr. Carter, whom she had a massive crush on, taught her about its hot springs and bubbling mud pools. She's always been one for adventures. A gap year in Thailand, physio placements in America and South Africa, and holidays twice a year. I never seem to have the money to do the same, even though I'd love to. And it doesn't help that Simon's idea of a big adventure is a long weekend in Cornwall. But I hope desperately Hannah isn't correct. The prospect of losing both my flatmate and my best friend at the same time would be too much to bear.
Nope,
she says. I let out a sigh of relief.
You've been given a promotion, says Lizzie.
Kat laughs.
Not likely.
True, says Hannah.
Oi,
says Kat, casting Hannah pretend daggers and reaching for another crisp. It's then that I see it. The light catches her hand, revealing the unmistakable sparkle of a diamond.
Henry asked you to marry him,
I say, hoping that my voice doesn't convey the sinking feeling in my stomach that all three of my closest friends are now settling down. I don't understand how it is that they're all so established in what they do and in their relationships. I'm still floundering, uncertain about the whole idea of marriage, and looking for the thing that enables me to have the life I've always dreamt of. A creative job and the chance to travel the world. Hannah and Lizzie's eyes dart expectantly between Kat and me, waiting for her to confirm one way or another. The pause feels unbearably long, and then suddenly, Kat's face breaks into an enormous smile and she squeals, holding up her hand for us all to see the ring.
Oh my God!
Lizzie shrieks, rushing over to hug her.
Congratulations, Kat, says Hannah, hugging her too. Such great news. Have you settled on a date?
We thought sooner rather than later, so we've decided on September.
September? Says Hannah. How can you possibly arrange a wedding in less than 5 months?
Because Kat isn't as OCD as you,
says Lizzie, baiting her mercilessly.
Ha, bloody ha,
says Hannah, screwing her face up at Lizzie. I'm still standing, rooted to the floor in shock when Kat turns to me. My response is too late to pull off genuine excitement, and I can't conceal the look of astonishment on my face. I fail to know how to react. And I'm angry with myself for spoiling my best friend's moment. Kat crosses to me.
Don't worry, Bea. Henry may be my husband, but he'll always be my best friend.
Immediately I can feel tears welling, and I pull her close.
I'm happy for you,
I whisper through my snuffles.
She pulls away to scrutinize my face.
I am, I promise.
I laugh, emotionally.
It's just a bit of a shock.
Kat laughs too.
Imagine how shocked I was. I'm not sure I ever expected Henry to be the one.
But he is? Even though I'm not really a believer in the one, I still want to be certain my dearest friend has made the right decision and hasn't just been caught up in the moment. When Lizzie introduced them 2 years ago at a drunken Christmas party due at the hospital where both Lizzie and Henry work, it never occurred to me that the slightly bombastic South African psychiatrist would turn out to be the person with whom Kat would spend the rest of her life. He's all nitpicky and contrary, and she's so laissez-faire. I can't pretend to understand the attraction.
He is, she says, the certainty in her eyes radiating out. Even if he is mad at the most of his patients.
Well, I can't argue with that, I say, laughing through my tears. We embrace again, me holding her until I'm certain she can feel the happiness I was unable to express in words.
Oh my God, says Lizzie, her eyes lighting up.
I recognize the look. It's the one that appears when she's cooking up some crazy plan or other. She claps her hands excitedly, and in that moment, I know exactly where her mind has wandered.
Do you remember when we were 13?
Yep, I think. She's going there.
And we made the pact for all of us to marry in the same summer.
She can't really think any of us will get on board with this as grown, responsible adults.
Oh, yeah, says Kat,
her eyes dancing up with delight.
And three of us are engaged, which means...
Hannah turns to me.
Have they lost their minds? We're 30, not 13.
If Simon proposes, it could be 4 weddings in one summer,
squeals Lizzie. I smear away the last of my tears, laughing at their craziness.
Oh my goodness, what an amazing thought,
shrieks Kat. She reaches out a hand to me, squeezing my arm. Bea, you're so going to be next. We have to get Simon to hurry up and propose so we can have our 4 weddings.
Guys, let's not get carried away, I say, noticing an alarmingly acrid smell coming from the kitchen.
Leaving the girls for a moment, I open the oven door and am greeted by a waft of smoke and a shriveled, charred chicken. I'm so not cut out for domestic bliss. As I attempt to rescue the chicken, I try to imagine my wedding to Simon. Really visualize it. With him in a grey morning suit and his mother in a hideous hat, wiping an elegant tear from her eye, and the girls grinning at me as I proceed down the aisle in a ludicrous meringue of a dress. But I can't. It isn't a real image. It's a parody of a Richard Curtis wedding. In fact, I can't imagine marrying Simon at all.
You okay?
Hannah is leaning against the doorway, watching me with concern. Hannah is the only one who has any inkling about my doubts about Simon. Kat has been so caught up with Henry recently that there hasn't been an opportunity to chat, and Lizzie is in her own loved-up little world. Hannah knows that I've begun to question whether part of the reason I've been hanging on to Simon is because of his slightly Hugh Grantish charm. Because recently, Si's old-world appeal has begun to wear a bit thin, and, if I'm perfectly honest, the spark we used to have has fizzled to a companionable glow. I've kept telling myself that's just what happens in long-term relationships, that it's better than falling in and out of love with unsuitable men, chasing the one, like my mum did. I'm fine, I say, shaking off my doubts.
Better than the chicken, anyway.
I hand her the salad to put on the table. Come on, let's eat. With the starter in place and everyone seated, Lizzie raises her glass.
A toast, she says, to Kat and Henry.
To Kat and Henry,
we chorus, clinking our glasses together.
And to Simon proposing, says Kat, with a glint in her eye. And our 4 wedding summer.
Our 4 wedding summer, I say with everyone else, though my mind is swimming with the prospect of Simon jumping on board the plan and proposing.
How would I ever turn him down without breaking his heart and bursting my friend's 4 weddings bubble in the process?
Chapter 2. It's mid-morning,
and despite having drunk a litre of water and an unspeakably revolting revitalizer shot from the local juice bar, my head is still foggy from last night. After the initial shock of Kat's news, the evening turned out to be fun enough, with the girls plotting and scheming as we sewed bunting for Lizzie's wedding. We ate the caramelized chicken, drank a couple of bottles of wine, and were all tucked up in bed before midnight. And yet still I woke this morning feeling as if a team of microscopic road workers had set to work on me overnight, one with a pneumatic drill in my left temple, a second having stripped the surface of my tongue and replaced it with gravel, and a third pouring hot tar over my eyes.
"You all right, Bee?"
asks Bev, catching me staring out of the window to Berkeley Square below.
"Huh?"
I say, unable to break my gaze. I've been focused on the same bloke on a bench drinking a coffee for ages.
"You seem a bit away with the fairies."
I turn my gaze towards her, at her desk opposite mine.
"Do I?"
She nods.
"Something the matter?"
Bev, Sir Hugo's diary secretary, is a little older than me, a mum of two teenage girls. Sometimes I wonder if she thinks of me as her third. I exhale long and loud and tell her about the four weddings plan, trying to sound breezy about Kat's engagement, but my skepticism is plainly written on my face.
"Are you feeling left behind?"
"It's not that, exactly. I'd like to tell her that, unlike the girls, I don't dream of settling down. That after a whole night of discussing the four weddings plan, I'm terrified that neither marriage nor Simon is right for me. And that I've been quietly thinking of ways to break up gently with Simon ever since I went to bed last night. But I can't tell her that, because Simon is Sir Hugo's son, and also the vice president of the company, so it's not exactly appropriate." I'm about to fudge some vague response about the prospect of feeling lonely without Kat and Lizzie in my day-to-day life, when Sir Hugo steps out of his office.
"Bee, did you get hold of the Matisse curator?"
Sir Hugo's voice is disconcertingly large, as is he. You don't get to be a world leader in public relations by being a shrinking violet. Despite my brain fog, I know that Hugo hasn't asked me to contact any curator, but rather than tell him so and bear the brunt of his temper, I instead think on my feet. "He's out of the country. His assistant has left him a message to call me."
"Fine. Anything else I need to know?"
"I found the film for the windows to protect your artwork." This is the job he asked me to do this morning, which he's confused with the curator.
"Very good. Talk to Lady Annabelle about having the work done at the house,"
he says, and returns to his office.
"I'm sure once the waters have settled, everything will be clearer," says Bev.
"I hope so," I say, absently sketching an earring on my notebook. Doodling jewellery designs always takes my mind off things. When I was a kid and my parents were getting divorced, I used to escape into my imagination by drawing sparkling necklaces for princesses, with shiny sequins stuck on as jewels, and elaborate rings made from tin foil and bits of wool that princes would give to their one true love. I was safe in that place, secure in my imagination, free of bickering parents and slamming doors. The design I'm creating now is a dangling feather of coloured beads, and I momentarily stop worrying about how to break up with Simon, and instead I'm transported back to that same safe place of endless stories and imagination.
"What's this?"
asks a voice, sometime later, when I'm fully absorbed in my drawing. It takes me a moment to rejoin the external world of the office and Simon, who is standing at my shoulder.
"Nothing!"
I rapidly close the book and swing my chair round to face him. His fresh face looks particularly boyish today. He kisses me square on the mouth, something I've always wished he wouldn't do at work. When we first started dating and he'd kiss me in the office, I was embarrassed that people might think I was taking liberties because I was seeing the boss's son. 4 years on, it still makes me cringe.
"It didn't look like nothing."
"Well, it was. I've no idea why I'm hiding it from him. It's not as if he'd care about me skiving for 5 minutes, but I don't want him just to dismiss it as a pretty doodle." For a second, he looks at me, perplexed, then shakes away whatever thought he was having. Simon rarely dwells on anything for long. At the beginning of our relationship,
The girls used to tease me by referring to him as Simple Simon. I hate to say it, but it kind of suits him.
What's going on? I ask, swinging in my chair.
I just popped by to see how you're doing. Everything okay?
Sure,
I shrug, trying to block the thoughts which are now screaming, he isn't right for you, break it off, stop stringing him along. Because the last thing I want is for him to see it in my eyes before I've spoken to him.
Why wouldn't it be?
Again, he looks at me, foxed by my clipped manner. He narrows his eyes.
You're remembering our date tonight?
Thursday night, same as every week.
Rules, 7:30?
Absolutely.
I can't wait, he says, smiling at me with a tenderness that is like a dagger to my heart.
Me too,
I say, and a part of me means it. For all I don't want to marry him, and for all I wish Simon were a little more spontaneous and exciting, there's no mistaking the fact that he's a really good guy. Someone I've spent 4 years of my life with. Someone I know absolutely adores me. Someone I really, really don't want to hurt. He kisses me lovingly on the lips, and for once I don't hurry him away. It's as if I'm trying to store the feeling in my memory bank, stashing it away for a rainy day.
You know it's better you let him go now rather than later, says Bev, once Simon is in his father's office.
I shoot her a look that says, I've no idea what you're talking about.
It will hurt him more in the long run if you try to hide it than if you're up front and honest now.
Is it really that obvious? I ask, knowing she's right, knowing it's best I tell him tonight.
Afraid so, says Bev,
with a motherliness that makes me want to burst into tears. The moment I see Simon waiting for me outside the restaurant, I feel twice as horrible about my plan to break up with him. My day was completely unproductive, given all I could think about was how to let him down without breaking his heart.
Early as ever,
I say, trying to sound light. I can't remember an occasion when Simon arrived after me. Tardiness isn't a concept he's familiar with, which always makes me feel a little bit guilty if I'm late. Not that he would ever want me to feel bad. It's part of his gentleman's approach to life, that a lady should never be left standing on her own. When we first met, it was one of the things that I found charming about him, but now I find it a little jarring, slightly out of touch with the world.
You look beautiful,
he says, kissing me lightly on the lips.
And you look very dapper.
Not helpful, Bee. But it's true. He does look dapper. Simon is always well turned out. During the week, he wears a three-piece suit and at weekends, jeans and a sharp shirt with brogues. He only ever wears cashmere sweaters and his socks never have holes in them. Many women would die for a man who prides himself on his appearance, but the trouble is, I'd prefer someone who'd just throw on an old pair of jeans and a rugby shirt, so that I might be able to relax too.
Shall we go in?
He asks, opening the door for me, oblivious to what I'm about to tell him. Rules is Simon's favourite restaurant. It's traditional and old-fashioned, but also incredibly warm with its brilliant red banquettes, crisp white linen, and walls covered in original drawings, paintings and cartoons. Over the years, food has been the glue to our relationship. Both of us could dine out every night of the week with three courses at each sitting without ever tiring, and Rules never leaves you feeling hungry.
Let's have a splurge, he says,
when we're sitting at a cozy table for two near the back. He rubs his hands together, his eyes shining at the thought of it. My stomach churns nervously.
In celebration of us.
He reaches over to take my hand and my heart fills with guilt. I remove my hand from his under the pretext of picking up the menu.
What are you going to have?
Always the broth, then steak and kidney pudding, and the steamed syrup sponge for dessert.
So a nice light option, then.
He laughs, watching me tenderly. I glance away.
What will you have?
Despite my turning stomach, I still feel like eating.
Pear and walnut salad, lamb shoulder, and pistachio and blackberry tart.
Delightful. Just like you.
I fiddle with the glassware, thinking about how to plant the seed of us breaking up. But just as I'm about to say something, the waiter arrives, and the moment is lost. How was your day? Simon asks once the order has been taken. Unproductive. Why so?
I've been sort of distracted.
Anything I can help with? He asks,
which is just like him, caring to the last. Tell him, Bea. Tell him you want to break up.
Kat and Henry are engaged, I say, unintentionally.
That's not telling him.
I wonder if he hasn't quite heard me because it takes him a moment to respond. He looks a little crestfallen, deflated even, as if he's been robbed of Kat, which makes no sense at all.
Well, that's wonderful news, he says, throwing back a glass of water as if it was something stronger. We should toast to their happiness.
He beckons the waiter and requests 2 glasses of champagne. But that's not all that was distracting me, I continue.
Come on, Bea, you can do it.
They're getting married in September.
Again, so not telling him.
Splendid, though I can see that would be distracting. Lots to help organize and not much time.
There's something about his tone that isn't quite right, but I can't figure out what it is. Right. And then Lizzie reminded us of a pact we made when we were teenagers that we'd all get married in one summer. I roll my eyes heavily in a worst idea ever sort of way, praying he won't pounce on the idea.
Good Lord, what a prospect. Would there have to be a funeral too?
We laugh. Simon heartedly, me slightly sadly. I'm reminded of how many laughs we've had over the years, because from time to time, Simon really does make me chuckle, and I'm sorry at the prospect of giving that up.
Now I think about it, my grandfather's been looking a bit peaky recently.
For all his good humour, there's something about it in this moment that sounds like a deflection, as if he's as shaken by the prospect of 4 weddings as I am. It's a bit of a relief when the food arrives and we've something else to talk about.
The broth is sensational, says Simon,
somewhat overzealously.
The salad is too.
There's a pause between us. I can hear him slurping.
You can always bank on rules, he says.
Yes, I say, wondering what he's thinking. Usually at dinner, Simon is swooning over me and doing his best to ensure there are no lulls in conversation, but currently he only has eyes for his food. It's as if he's trying to eat and get out as quickly as is humanly possible. And then it hits me. Perhaps Simon doesn't want to marry me. Perhaps all these months that I've been sensing things aren't right between us, he's been feeling the same way. Perhaps he's also having doubts about our future. I told the girls not to get their hopes up about the 4 weddings thing, I say, tentatively testing my theory.
Yes, good plan.
He barely looks up from his plate. Because I'm not sure we're on that page yet, right? I say carefully.
Absolutely, couldn't agree more,
he says, brisk in his delivery.
So that's that. He feels the same way I do. But probably best not to break up tonight. Let it happen when the moment's right, when we're both ready.
Although it's what I want, it's still a shock, and I feel an even deeper pang of sadness for all we'd be losing. 4 years is a long time to spend with someone, learning all their little foibles. Simon always has to wear socks in bed, even in a heatwave. And seeing them through highs and lows. Lady Annabel had breast cancer last year, which floored the whole family. I hope, at the very least, we'll be able to remain friends. After we've worked our way uncomfortably through the main course and our plates have been cleared, the waiter appears and asks theatrically if we're ready for dessert. Simon clears his throat and says, rather grandly, like his father,
Actually, there's been a change of plan. We'll have to renege on dessert this time.
Really? When did we ever pass on pudding?
Very good, sir. May we have our coats?
Of course. As the waiter helps me with my jacket, Simon says,
Why don't you wait outside while I settle up?
Sure, I reply. Thankful for the chance to catch a breath of fresh air, even if I am disappointed to miss out on a suite. I'm contemplating Simon's feelings about us when I catch sight of him through the restaurant window. He's engaged in a discussion with the waiter, which seems more animated than one would expect for a simple bill transaction. Perhaps there's a problem with the card, or, more probably, the realization that it's time to call things off between us has sent him into a bit of a spin.
It's not ideal, but I'm relieved we'll be parting on mutual terms, rather than one of us being left heartbroken.
Chapter 3. It's just like Lizzie to choose to have her hen night with her fiancé. I swear it's as if one would die without the other. It's a miracle they've survived the last year. They've barely seen each other, with Jack off touring the country and recording his band's album in some farmhouse in Dorset. In fairness, she had planned a girls-only night, but when the band, Carburetor, landed a gig at the Roundhouse, there was no way on this earth she was going to miss it.
"Isn't this the greatest night ever? I'm so proud of him," she says,
between sucking on a whiskey and coke, Lizzie's tipple of choice. In our final years at school, Lizzie used to fill a hip flask with whiskey from her father's drinks cabinet and sneak out to the barn where we'd mix it with coke and drink it from mugs behind the hay bales. Hannah was always really nervous about getting caught. Cat couldn't care less, and I giggled myself silly. Nothing much has changed.
"It is pretty cool," I say, taking an incredible venue with its cast iron columns supporting the domed roof.
It's early evening and the doors aren't yet open. The band are doing their sound check, Jack tweaking his drum kit. Lizzie and I are sitting in the balcony with our feet on the backs of the chairs in front. She examines the Access All Areas pass hanging round her neck and beams.
"Can you be a groupie if you're engaged to one of the band?"
"Not sure. Maybe as wife-to-be you're considered crew. The rest of us get to be the groupies." I wave to Kat, who's just arrived.
"Look at you, Mrs. Jack-to-be," she says, hugging Lizzie.
She takes in the venue and the band up on stage.
"This really is your nirvana, isn't it?"
"The only thing closer would be if I were marrying Kurt Cobain himself."
Kat laughs and rubs Lizzie's arm affectionately, probably thinking, as I am, about Lizzie's Kurt Cobain obsession as a teenager.
"I think Jack has a kind of Kurt Cobain look about him."
"Do you really?"
"I've thought it myself, but..."
Lizzie's train of thought is broken by Jack jumping off the stage, his tall, lean figure winding up to the balcony.
"Hi,"
he says, stooping to lovingly kiss Lizzie. She strokes his beard and gazes into his light blue eyes as if they've been apart for weeks, and sweeps his scruffy blonde hair back off his face.
"How's it going down there?"
I ask, when they've stopped mooning. "Everything coming together?"
"Yeah, B. It's all good,"
he says, sounding as he always does, as if he's smoked a dozen spliffs.
"Simon mentioned you're having your stag do next weekend."
"It's gonna be great,"
he says, bobbing his head, happy to let a long pause hang in the air.
"I can't really imagine Simon in a beer bath,"
I say.
"You have to take photos," says Kat.
The idea of Henry up to his waist in beer is too good to be true.
Jack, Simon, and Henry's friendship is an unlikely one. Simon is old-fashioned and straight as you get. Henry always a ball of fiery energy, and Jack, as laid-back a person as I've ever known. But one way or another, because of us girls, they've forged an alliance of their own. The prospect of them all hanging out with Jack's bandmates at a beer spa cracks me up. Or it would, if my stomach didn't clench with guilt every time I think about Simon.
"Well, I'd better get back to it. Coming?"
he asks Lizzie, reaching for her hand. They head off together, their arms wrapped tightly around each other as they walk.
"They really are love's young dream," says Kat.
"Sickening, isn't it?"
"I've never known two people more in love."
I turn to her.
"Not even you and Henry?"
Kat chuckles.
"I think it's fair to say we aren't so demonstrative as Lizzie and Jack.
I'm not sure there's any couple out there as outwardly affectionate as those two." Jack and Lizzie have their arms locked round each other's waists, walking around the stage, Jack pointing out all the technical stuff.
It's as if they're one person.
"Like you and Simon."
Kat's comment stops me short, the reality of the demise of our relationship suddenly hitting home.
"B?"
she asks, when I don't respond. I stare straight ahead at the stage. "I think we're about to break up."
"Yeah, right."
"I'm serious," I say, turning towards her, my eyes confirming it's true. She looks at me as if I've lost my mind.
"Simon adores you almost as much as Lizzie adores Jack."
That's what I thought. But when I told him the other night about how Lizzie has cooked up the idea of a four-wedding summer, I tail off, lost in the memory of telling him. And? And he couldn't get out of the restaurant fast enough. Kat furrows her brow. That doesn't sound like him. I thought he'd have jumped at the chance of proposing. Apparently not. How does that feel? I pause, not wanting to betray Simon by telling Kat I had planned to break up with him first. Honestly? Honestly? I feel a bit relieved. This time it's Kat's turn to stop short, trying to make sense of what I've just told her. Simon and I have been dating the longest out of all of us. We met when I started working for Sir Hugo. He's become part of the group. It wouldn't be just my loss, it would be theirs too. I just assumed, after all this time, that's the direction you were headed in. Right, I nod. Maybe I did too. Or maybe I hadn't given it much thought, but when Lizzie mentioned the four weddings idea, I just saw it. Clear as day. Simon and marriage aren't for me. Kat laughs. Are you the Charles of this group? I laugh too. Do you remember how much of a crush you had on Hugh Grant in Four Weddings? I'd still swap Henry for Hugh any day of the week. I believe it. Though funnily enough, I don't think Lizzie would swap Jack for Kurt, even if he wasn't dead. Kat glances over to the two of them now sitting on the edge of the stage, Lizzie's head on Jack's shoulder. You know, you don't have to marry Simon. You could do what Charles and Carrie did and agree not to marry. I'm pretty confident that wouldn't sit comfortably with Simon. He's more the traditional marrying type. Yes, I suppose it would mean him giving up on his dream of a wedding at St. Paul's Cathedral.
With the reception at the palace.
Kat laughs for a moment until it becomes clear that I'm not laughing, that I'm actually feeling quite low about it all. Do you really feel it's right for both of you to end it? It breaks my heart to say it, but yes. As much as I respect him, as much as I hope we can remain friends, the thing that should be there isn't. What thing? You know, I say, surprised that she's asking. Her expression is blank. The spark, the chemistry, the thing that no one else sees but you. Right, of course, says Kat, nodding quietly. So, what are you going to do about it?
Hope he ends things first?
Our conversation is cut short by the arrival of Hannah and Remy, who blends in perfectly in her asymmetric linen tunic and leggings, her hair in a bun with spiky ends, unlike Hannah, who couldn't look more out of place if she tried. She's got her stiff lawyer suit on, and her hair is scraped tightly off her face. Lizzie runs up to greet them. How are you? She asks, kissing Remy twice on her flawless cheeks, but Remy goes for a third and they end up kissing on the lips. Lizzie turns crimson.
Dreadful, says Hannah.
What's up? I ask.
It is nothing, says Remy in her thick French accent.
She reaches for Hannah's hand, her dark eyes looking lovingly at her fiancé.
Anna worries too much.
She's good at that, I say, remembering how much time Hannah spent chewing her nails over exams.
If my grandparents still not knowing about you, Hannah says to Remy, and the wedding photographer pulling out at the last moment is your idea of nothing, then it's nothing.
You can have our photographer's number. He's amazing, says Lizzie, brightly. He knows one of your yoga clients, she says to Remy. That's how I got his details. When I was at one of your classes. He's really brilliant, just sometimes a little hard to pin down.
I'll take anyone at this stage, says Hannah. Who wants a drink?
Lizzie's hand shoots straight up in the air. Definitely me. With a laugh, I say, I could use one too. I feel my phone vibrate in my pocket as Hannah and Remy head off to the bar. It's Simon. Any chance you could pop round later, there's something we need to talk about. What's up? Asks Kat. My face must give away my feeling of trepidation. Looks like he's going to be the one to break up with me, I say, handing my phone to her. She puts an arm around me and pulls me in. Guess it's time you face the music. I ducked out early from the hen night, telling Lizzie I was too exhausted to be much fun, but that I'd see her at home. She was so absorbed in the set that it was easy not to tell her about Simon, which I knew would spoil her night more than me leaving early. The air is surprisingly warm for April when I leave Victoria Station. It transports me back to an evening 3 summers ago when Simon and I had been to a concert at Kenwood House, after which we'd sauntered back to his place from the tube. My feet were aching from a new pair of shoes, and rather than have me go barefoot, Simon had given me a piggyback. We were tipsy and full of giggles and in love. It was one of those evenings where the world seemed perfect in every way. As I cross the road towards Eaton Square, I wonder how all of that slipped away without us noticing. By the time I turn onto his cobbled street, where he lives with his siblings in the mews at the back of his father's house, I've bolstered myself for what is to come. Better that it's mutual, I say to myself before ringing the bell. Sophie, his 18-year-old sister, answers.
Hi, Bea.
Hi, Sophie. As she lets me in, it hits me that I won't just be losing Simon, but his siblings too, who've welcomed me into their home these last few years without protest. I've seen Sophie transform from a gawky teenager into a beautiful woman, and Ed change from a lazy student to a busy professional. How are you?
Good, I'm good, she says.
Why does she sound nervous? As Simon told her what's about to happen.
Let me take your coat.
I'll keep it on.
Don't be silly,
she says, removing it for me. I figure she's trying to make me feel better about the inevitable.
Simon's upstairs.
As I climb the stairs, I'm aware that Sophie's watching me from below. I give her a little wave and she dashes away with a giggle. Weird. At the top of the stairs, I call out for Simon.
In my bedroom, he calls back.
I take a deep breath, steadying myself for what is to come. I adopt a solemn demeanor. But what I see when I enter the room changes everything.
I was worried he wouldn't come, he says.
There's a long pause as I fully take in the scene, my eyes widening in horror. His room is festooned with candles and more roses than I've ever seen in my life. Then Simon removes a small box from his pocket and starts to awkwardly get down on bended knee.
Oh, fuck, I whisper.
Beatrice Jennifer Henshaw, he says, his voice grave and sincere. Will you marry me?
My mind should be a whirl of activity and my emotions running riot, but they're not. It's almost as if both have stopped working altogether. All I can do is stare. After what must have been 30 seconds at least, Simon says,
Will you?
His words give me a start and I feel my heart begin to race.
Yes?
He asks, eagerly.
I thought you were breaking up with me, I blurt.
His puppyish expression falters.
Why would you think that?
He asks, still down on one knee. I crouch down beside him in a kind of awkward squat.
The other night at Rules, when I mentioned Lizzie's 4 weddings plan, you pretty much bolted from the restaurant.
It surprises me when he laughs. Relaxing enough to sit rather than kneel.
That's because I was going to propose during dessert. I had it all planned out. The waiter was going to bring champagne and a cake after I'd popped the question. But when you mentioned Lizzie's plan, I thought you'd think I was asking because of that, not because I've been thinking since last summer about proposing to the girl I love.
Oh, God, that makes perfect sense. How could I have got it so wrong?
And afterwards, when you were paying the bill, you had to explain to the waiter what had happened.
He was quite animated about it all, and sorry that things hadn't worked out. I laugh dismally.
I thought you were in a flat because you'd realized you were having doubts about us.
He turns to me, his eyes burning with sincerity.
I could never have doubts about us. You mean everything to me.
I inhale sharply. How the hell do I back out of this one? Just then there's a knock at the door.
What is it?
Simon calls.
What did she say? Can I come in?
Sophie's face pops round the door. She is beside herself with excitement, and I feel horrible when the penny drops and her smile fades.
Maybe give us a little more time,
I say, trying to sound encouraging, even though I know it's only providing false hope.
Okay,
she whispers, sneaking away. I guess Us isn't just us, I say, which makes this 10 times harder. Sophie and Ed adore you too, as do Mom and Dad. It's then I realize that if I say no to Simon, work will become unbelievably difficult. How could I possibly face Sir Hugo, who's always been so kind to me, after turning down his son? And how could I continue to work with Sai after breaking his heart? But my sibling shouldn't influence your decision. All that really matters is you and me. I've no idea how to make this easy on him. The trouble is, I say, taking his hand, I'm just not sure I'm the marrying sort. Simon laughs as if I'm joking. I'm serious. My dad left us when I was 5. I didn't have a positive male role model. I grew up seeing my mother doing everything on her own and coping just fine without a husband. But think how much easier it would have been for her if she'd had the support of a good husband. And I'd be a good husband to you, Bea. You wouldn't want for anything. I look into his eyes, which are brimming with sincerity. I can't deny it. There is a part of me that thinks it would be easy to say yes. Because if anyone would be a good husband, it's Simon. His parents would help us buy a house. We'd throw dinner parties for his university friends. We'd end up with a brood of angel-faced children and a clutch of spaniels, even better behaved than the kids. But then a little voice at the back of my head reminds me about my dream of being a jewelry designer and not being tied to one place. I know that. I do, I say, squeezing his hand. But, he asks, sensing the inevitable. But I don't think it's the life I want. I want more than stability. I want a creative life, a life of freedom, one that doesn't involve dressing for society dinners and writing endless thank you cards. He looks at the ring in the box that he's still clasping. Go easy, Bea. I'm so sorry, Simon, but I think the answer is no. In our 4 years together, I've never seen Simon cry, not even when his mother was diagnosed with breast cancer. But now his eyes flood with tears. God, this is horrible. I'm so very sorry. My words are barely audible. But I think it's right. For both of us. Perhaps. Or maybe I'm making the worst decision of my life. Chapter 4. There were endless things to say after Simon and I broke up. But we decided not to drag it out all there and then, agreeing it was best we both slept on it and talk things through when the time felt right. My plan was to take the tube straight home, but in the end I found myself walking through the park towards Notting Hill, which made me think of all the times I forced Simon to watch the movie with me, and how he always pretended to enjoy it just as much as the first time we watched it together. And then, one way or another, I kept on walking towards Holland Park, Shepherd's Bush, and then Acton. By the time I arrived back at the house, my feet were aching, which somehow made the pain in my heart more tolerable. Lizzie was asleep when I got in, and up and out before me, so I didn't have the chance to tell her what had happened, though even if she had been around, I'm not sure I would have mentioned it. Taking time to process the decision on my own first felt the right thing to do. This morning I tidied the house from top to bottom. Lizzie's wedding paraphernalia has started to take over the place, only stopping to check my phone. Whenever it pinged or rang, I immediately checked to see if it was Simon. But he didn't call, choosing, like me I guess, to lick his wounds alone. But there was only really one person I needed to talk to. My mother's aunt, Great Aunt Jane. As soon as I rang to ask if I could come over in the evening, she instantly knew that something was wrong. But rather than tell her then and there, I told her we'd discuss it tonight. After that, I filled my afternoon by sketching necklaces in front of Richard Curtis Films, an old copy of the National Geographic on the sofa open at an article about traditional Native American weaving and beadwork. Before I knew it, time had got away with me, and I needed to get ready to go out.
"What's happened?" asks Aunt Jane, opening the door to her pied-à-terre in Chelsea. Aunt Jane's never been one for small talk.
"Simon proposed," I say, taking off my coat, which she hangs in the tiny entrance hall, every inch of which is covered in artwork and artifacts from all over the world. I've known this flat since I was very young, when Aunt Jane was still working full-time at her auction house in Lotts Road, but I still find things that surprise me.
And?
I said no.
Good decision,
she says bluntly, and I laugh.
He was far too conventional for you.
There's no one in the world I trust more to get straight to the point than Aunt Jane. When we were teenagers and Mum was at work, the girls and I used to pile round to her house in Chippenham, her old family home that she'd inherited from her mother, and which she referred to as her retirement project. Not that Aunt Jane ever fully retired. Even now, in her 70s, she's still got a hand in the business. In the kitchen, round an old oak table, she'd offer us candid advice and the best hot chocolate known to man. I'm convinced she used to put a dash of rum in it, even when we were only 13. Aunt Jane may be my great aunt, but for years she's been like a surrogate aunt to the others. I follow her tall figure through to her elegant living room, an homage to everything mid-20th century, where she immediately pours me a large gin and tonic.
It's true, he's very nice and very rich, but all the money in the world can't make up for a lack of zing.
She gestures for me to relax on the sofa while she heads into the galley kitchen for some nibbles. A cool spring breeze blows gently through the window, bringing with it the smell of the first cut grass of the season from the public garden beyond. As I wait for Aunt Jane, a photo catches my eye on her 1950s record player cabinet. It's of Hannah, Cat, Lizzie, and me, sitting on her sofa back when we were 15 or 16. I guess it was taken during a school holiday when Aunt Jane used to let us crash there for days on end. We loved the fact she allowed us to sit out in the garden until all hours of the morning, chatting about films and music and what our futures might hold, and forgetting for a while about exams and body image and boys.
Where did you find that photo?
I call through to the kitchen. Aunt Jane returns with a tray of nibbles, a small floral apron wrapped round her long belted skirt.
Isn't it super?
She says, placing the tray on the table and rolling up the sleeves of her cream blouse.
I was having a clear out and found it in a box. You all look so youthful, so untouched by the world.
At the time, we felt we knew it all. She laughs lightly, her emerald eyes dancing.
Do you remember when Lizzie thought she was pregnant because she sat on a toilet seat with the lid up?
Oh, yeah.
That was out there, even by her standards. There was always some drama unfolding.
I guess some things never change, I say, distantly, my mind wandering to Simon. Aunt Jane sits down beside me, offering me an olive on a cocktail stick.
You've done the right thing, Bee.
Then why do I feel so awful?
Because you've a good heart. And the last thing you want is for someone you care deeply for to be hurting.
Maybe, I say, biting the olive from its stick. I wonder what Mum would have to say.
I expect she'd tell you you've made a mistake. But then, how much should you trust the advice of a woman who's notoriously bad at finding husbands?
Aunt Jane, you can't say that, I say, smiling.
Why not? It's the truth, isn't it?
I shake my head with a laugh. My mother married my father after a whirlwind romance when she was only 21. The marriage came crashing down 7 years later when she discovered that he'd been seeing another woman from almost the moment she became pregnant with me. She was forced to sell up the nice family house, move into a two-up, two-down on an estate, and take a job at Tesco's, which I guess is what happens when you get married before you've figured out what to do with your life. Just after I left home, she married someone else, moving to Mallorca to be with him. Turned out he was a cheating scumbag too. He left her after a couple of years for someone else, but she got to keep their villa and some cash, so at least something good came of it. Now she lives with her dogs in the sunshine, occasionally dating holidaying Brits, but mostly she keeps herself to herself.
If Simon walked through that door right now and proposed for a second time, would you say yes?
No. It surprises me just how quickly I reply.
So there's your answer.
You're right, I know you're right, I say, leaning in to examine the olives. It's just super confusing with everyone around me getting married.
Even Kat's engaged, I tell you.
Aunt Jane shakes her head. Apparently Henry is the one after all.
You don't sound convinced?
I inhale, thinking while I munch on an olive. Maybe it's more I'm unconvinced about the idea of the one, I say, parking my uncertainty about Kat and Henry. Do you believe in the one? Aunt Jane shrugs lightly,
as if it's not something she's given much thought to. Maybe there was someone once, but that was many moons ago.
This comes as a surprise to me. In all the time I've known Aunt Jane, I've never known her date anyone.